Hi, welcome to Speaking of Sex with the Pleasure Mechanics. This is Chris from PleasureMechanics.com, and on today's episode, we are going to be talking about sexual bullying and how it affects us all, no matter what our age or relationship status. Joining us today is Emily Linden, founder of the Unslut Project. Emily, welcome to Speaking of Sex.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Let's start by introducing the Unslut Project to our listeners. How did this project start and what are your goals?
I will answer your questions, I guess, in reverse order. The goal is to make the word slut not make sense as an insult anymore. Mm. So it sounds counterintuitive, but the goal is to kind of put myself out of a job to make the movement obsolete, because we're hoping that in a couple decades, tops, the word slut will just seem like, you know, hussy or floozy or something that is silly and doesn't really apply to women's lives anymore, because we're also comfortable with female sexuality and everything that entails.
Amen.
Yeah.
We're so with the you.
I know. And actually, it's a movement that has had a lot of support, and it started organically. And I think that's what's so special about the Unslut Project, is that I thought 2 years ago, a little over 2 years ago, when I started it, that it was just going to be a blog of my own diary entries from when I was labeled a school slut when I was in middle school. So starting from age 11, I got this reputation that I was that slutty girl. And it came close to ruining my life over the next few years. And when I started hearing stories about girls who had gone through something similar in recent years, and who, unlike me, hadn't been able to overcome it and had made the decision to take their own life because of sexual bullying, I figured this is a quirky and kind of new way, really unique way, to contribute to the conversation, is to share from inside the mind of an 11-year-old girl through her diaries what it's like to actually go through that. And I was lucky to have saved those diaries in my parents' house where I grew up. And so I just kind of put them on Tumblr. And as soon as I did that, it was almost as if it served as an invitation for women who had gone through something similar to speak up and start sending their stories to me. And so accidentally, really serendipitously, I started collecting all these experiences from women and men who had witnessed slut shaming, and girls who were currently going through it, from all over the world. And it became really clear to me that I had kind of tapped into something that people were really ready to talk about finally, and to try to work against and make, make progress on this issue. So the Unslut Project has developed over the past couple of years to be a movement of people who've, you know, either experienced slut shaming themselves and overcome it and want to share their stories to let girls know that it can get better, and of people who've witnessed it, and people who are lucky enough to never have really had personal experience with slut shaming, but just care a lot about women being able to be either, you know, sexually free in the ways that make sense to them and authentic ways, or on the other side and really tragic side of the spectrum are girls and women who are the victims of sexual assault and as a result are slut shamed. And so giving those women support too.
And can you give us a quick definition of slut shaming? What does that look like? And is it the same as sexual bullying?
It's not necessarily exactly the same. So I define slut shaming. I always put the word slut in quotation marks, which not everyone does. But I think it's important to distinguish that we're not really endorsing the use of the word slut, and we don't buy into its meaning. So slut in quotes shaming, I define as implying that a girl or woman should feel guilty or inferior for her real or even perceived sexual behavior. So it's broad, and it appears in all different ways, from kind of rolling your eyes and joking about how trashy a woman looks at a bar because you feel threatened or insecure next to her. It ranges from that to large-scale media slut shaming of people like Miley Cyrus, and not providing any context to children when we talk about it, and kind of passing on this message that that's an okay thing to do. Sexual bullying, on the other hand, is a term that I use mostly when I'm talking to middle schools and high schools, because the word bullying is such a hot topic right now. This idea that kids are really mean to each other, and that it can lead to suicides and really ruined lives, if not suicides, is something that parents and teachers are really interested in working on. So sexual bullying allows us to talk about slut shaming in that specific context, and bring people on board who, when they might hear the term slut shaming, would think, oh, well, I don't know anything about that, and I don't really want to talk about that with kids. The sexual bullying aspect of it is kind of more specific, if that makes sense.
Yeah, and it's such a smart move because, you know, looking back at my own childhood, I always knew that I was bullied for being fat, that I was bullied for being too loud. And it was only when I heard the term that it clicked in that I was actually sexually bullied almost every day through middle school and high school. And it was a huge part of my experience. And I myself considered suicide countless times because of sexual bullying, and yet I never had language for it. And I'm curious how, when you speak to teenagers, how many people have this aha moment when they realize they've been bullied in this very subtle or not so subtle way, and that that's defining their sexuality.
I'm so sorry that you went through that. And what you're describing and kind of this aha moment that you're saying is really, really common. Almost every woman I speak to, like 95 to 100% of women will say, as I share my experience with them or kind of describe the Unslut Project, they have this look come over their face of, oh my gosh, that's, I've gone through that. That describes my experience. And the sexual bullying, as you describe, is something that I think girls who get through middle school and high school thinking maybe they've not been bullied because it hasn't looked like, you know, physical bullying or being shoved into a locker or, you know, told that you're fat and ugly or these ways that we generally think of bullying looking, all of a sudden realize that's why I was so upset and anxious, because people assuming that I was a slut and boys assuming they could touch my body and people making jokes about me and spreading rumors, that is a form of bullying if you experience it that way. It's important to have that realization and to then have, like you said, vocabulary to talk about it with kids who are going through it right now.
Yeah, and my experience was before Facebook, before social media, and I think we agree that sexual bullying has always happened. But do you think that social media makes the experience more brutal and more urgent for girls?
I'm in the same boat as you. I'm 29 now, and so when I was going through sexual bullying, we had AIM, like AOL Instant Messenger, but it wasn't, I mean, there was no social media the way there is today. I don't necessarily know that it's made it worse. I hear from a lot of women who are in older generations who suffered terribly and who continue to suffer throughout their lives because of their experiences decades ago. But it has made it more constant. It's made it so that leaving school and just physically separating yourself from the bullies isn't enough because you always have your phone with you. You know, you're always at a computer and you have access. People have access to you, I guess, ongoing, and they can continue bullying you. And it's also, you know, on the flip side, the positive side, made it more visible so that people like me and people who like parents and administrators who might not necessarily have evidence of this type of bullying before all of a sudden do and realize that this language and these assumptions that are held about female sexuality really come out in this type of bullying. So there's the positive side of bullying that happens on social media versus bullying that happens in person, but it does make it much more difficult to escape ongoing bullying.
Mm. And you mentioned, we talk to a lot of women and men who are still haunted by sexual bullying that happened 10, 20, 30 years ago. And the slut shaming, the bullying they experienced then holds them back in the bedroom now with their long-term partners. Do you have any advice for people who are still burdened by this? Like, how do you expel those demons?
It's a personal journey. I mean, like any kind of struggle that you're going through, I don't have one type of, what's the phrase I'm looking for? One size fits all advice. Uh-huh. But I do think that the sharing of our personal stories is cathartic for us. I mean, I know it has been for me, and it allows you to connect with your partner to the extent that you're able to talk about it or maybe write it down. A lot of the submissions, most of the submissions we get are written versus someone recording their voice or even, you know, making a video message or something like that. So writing it down, if you're uncomfortable really putting into spoken words how this has affected you, I think can be really helpful. And sharing that with your partner and even with people in your life who aren't your sexual partner who you think could support and help you. So, you know, parents who might have participated in the slut shaming, but you're now friends with as an adult. I know that talking to my parents about it has really helped our relationship and has helped me kind of cope with it as an adult and figure out what it means for my current sex life. Because it really, I mean, it's hard to quantify the amount, the effect that it can have throughout your adult life. It's a type of thing that each woman who's taking stock of the different relationships she's had and the different ways she's interacted with people and had sex throughout her adult life it kind of colors the whole thing. I think in ways that might even surprise herself, you know, might surprise the woman herself as she's reckoning with it. And so talking about it, and if you're unable to talk about it, which is completely understandable, writing it down and either just in a diary so that you have it on paper and you can cope with it yourself, or sharing it with your partner if you feel it's hindering your sexual life, or with people in your life who would support you. That's, I think, the only kind of general advice that I can give without knowing someone personally.
Yeah, that's great advice. So often people write to us with a struggle and it's this vague sense of unease in their body or with receiving pleasure, and we start digging, and then it goes back to this moment in middle school or high school, and we have to say to that person, you know, does Billy on the playground have that much power over you still? And there's this moment of, well, no, of course not. And that can begin the process of letting it go. And so it's this process of identifying the messages you got. And yet we know that it's not just teenagers that are bullied. So many adults still feel slut shamed, still censor their sexuality because of the social gaze. How do you think about that versus teenage bullying? What is the experience for an adult like versus a teenager?
I think it's important to, what you're describing is entirely true. And one of the misconceptions about telling teenagers and preteens that don't worry, once you leave high school, it'll all be over, is that that's not true. That's a misconception. And not that you can't overcome it and it won't get better, but it will get better because of you, if that makes sense. Like when you get older, you get more perspective about this and you'll have the emotional tools to, as you said, kind of dig around in your past and figure out what might be hindering you and work through it. And you have the power to bring yourself to a therapist who can help you and to surround yourself with people who support you. When you're a teenager or preteen, there's no way logically for you to have that perspective of an adult. You just can't. And you're also surrounded by these random people who happen to have parents who are in vaguely the same socioeconomic class as your parents are and who have chosen to rent or buy a home in the same area. And you get thrown in with these people who are your own age, but really you have nothing else in common with them necessarily. And you haven't chosen them to be in your life. And so that's a social situation that doesn't occur ever again in your life. I mean, you could be in a toxic work environment, but to some extent you have control over that as an adult more than you might as a child. And that's, I think, the main difference is the tools that you have as an adult to help yourself that aren't available to you always as a kid. Other than that, though, assuming that it will get better is a misconception, because that's the world we live in. That's the culture we live in. And it's not right. It's not good. But it's not that adults have it all figured out. I mean, kids don't just grab out of thin air reasons to bully each other. They learn from the adults in their lives who model that type of nasty behavior toward other people, and that judgmental behavior toward people for whatever they dislike about them. Kids pick up on that. And the idea that girls who are somehow sexy or perceived to be having sexual behaviors with boys in the class or whatever it is, you know, the girl who's in the wrong place at the wrong time and you think might like your boyfriend. I mean, any of these reasons to make up to slut shame someone, girls and boys in high school and middle school learn that that is wrong. And they learn that from their parents and the media. They don't just make it up on their own. So when I talk to adults about it, one of the things I always try to stress is that it's not just a kid's issue. It's not just, oh, kids will be kids. Oh, they're so mean to each other these days. Oh, this crazy social media thing. We have nothing to do with it. That's not true. And assuming that's true is really dangerous and really unfair to the kids who don't have the tools that we have to work through it.
Yeah, it seems like we all have the responsibility to kind of do an inventory of ourselves and how we participate in this slut-shaming culture and the sexual violent language we use. And I think that's a really important point of this process, is to hold ourselves accountable too for the sexual culture we create around us. Do you find that by engaging in self-inventory and trying to be more responsible about the language we use ourselves, we can create better friendships and a better environment for the people around us? Does that make sense?
Yes. Yes. I think I love that idea of self-inventory and self-awareness. That is, in my opinion, always the first step. And it's easy, you know, because the Unslut Project is driven by personal stories, that's sometimes the only step that people can take. And it's an important step for them to recognize their own personal relationship with this concept of slut shaming and what it has meant to them, and with their sexuality in general. And beyond that, you know, once you kind of achieve that self-inventory and recognizing what experiences, what assumptions in your life have shaped the way you interact with other people and the judgments you make, you can then move on to your small social circle and your community, no matter how big or small it is. And if we all did that, think of, you know, all the different communities where those changes are happening, and then it becomes, by extension, large-scale social change. We can't just sweepingly change these centuries and centuries throughout almost every recorded culture around the world where female sexuality has been understood to be dangerous and bad and dirty and wrong. It takes time. And I think that's something that is really important to recognize, but it doesn't need to take that much time. I mean, if we all start with ourselves and kind of work outward, that can happen really rapidly.
Amen. Let's do it. And I was looking at some research, and I saw that the word slut dates back to at least 1402. And on top of that, for thousands of years, the church and state has policed women's sexual behavior with shaming and the constant threat of severe violence. And we now seemingly live in a culture where there's much more sexual freedom and choice. But how has the word slut continued to be used to shame and control women's behavior? What does that look like? Can you give some examples?
Sure. I mean, the word slut, I should be clear that slut shaming doesn't always involve the word slut. It can be much broader and kind of nebulous and still have the same effect. But the point you make about the constant threat of physical danger being gone, in many parts of the world, it's not. I mean, women are still stoned to death for adultery in different, not here in the United States. So people kind of assume that because in the United States, we see sex everywhere, you know, sex sells. So we see representations of women's scantily clad bodies, and we think, oh, that equals sexual maturity or sexual progressiveness. But it really doesn't. It reinforces norms about what is sexy. And those norms don't always align with what feels authentically sexy to adult women. And it doesn't always align to the experience of discovering what makes you feel sexy and what feels right and comfortable for pubescent and recently pubescent girls. So that's why we have to be a part of the conversation and shape it. And I think in the United States and Canada today, it's happening slowly, but comprehensive sex ed is a real part of that. So the education of kids from an early age in an age-appropriate way is one of the broader ways that we can work against this. And I've gotten a little ahead of myself. I want to go back and make sure I answer your question of what slut shaming looks like today, if not a constant threat of physical violence. The term constant threat still applies. Right. There is a constant threat of life destruction. Even if we are not, you know, legally murdered by our fathers today for having sex before we are married off to whoever's purchased us. I mean, even if that still isn't our reality in the United States, there is the constant threat that at any point someone could offhand make a remark about the way you're dressed at work, and that could destroy your career. Or if I sent a picture to my husband, and later he's my ex-husband, and he shares it with people in his life or people in my life, that could not just be soul-crushing, but it could have economic repercussions for me as a person and for my family. So it's still this real constant threat that hinges on our cultural understanding of female sexuality as something to be ashamed of, something that I should be ashamed of if that picture gets spread of me. And I think often the solution is like, well, just don't do anything sexy. Just don't put yourself out there with pictures. You know, don't share pictures with your intimate partners. Don't give people opportunities to slut shame you. And that is the biggest misconception behind, I think, the whole response, the negative response to our work, is that there's anything a girl or woman could possibly do to avoid being slut-shamed, because that's not true. Slut-shaming depends on the people who are doing the slut-shaming, and it depends on our collective understanding that sexuality is something for women to be ashamed of. So, you know, hopefully a couple decades from now, if a woman is running for Congress, let's say, and a photo gets spread around of her that she had sent to an intimate partner years before, people will shrug. It won't even be news. It'll be, who cares? She's a person. Let's get over it. And it won't be, part of the 24-hour news cycle like it would be today. That's my hope, is that we don't endorse it as a culture.
Yeah. And when we talk to women, there seems to be a can't win scenario going on where if they're too sexual and experience too much pleasure, they feel like a slut or a whore. If they're not sexual enough, they're a prude and unlovable. And it's this narrow window to operate in. And even things like, do you enjoy anal sex or BDSM, has this very loaded message about who you are as a person. And this is another area we need to start opening that window and allowing more permissiveness for different expressions of sexuality. Are you seeing that happen? Do you feel like there's a little bit more freedom as we have these things like the Slut March and we are having these online dialogues? Are women supporting one another in having a wider range of sexual expression, or do you think it's still pretty narrow?
In some places. So I kind of walk the line and bridge these two worlds to me that have a lot of overlap, and we all live in more than one sphere. But I'm part of the feminist blogosphere, and I'm part of a few different overlapping movements of people who are trying to make the internet a less misogynist place and are trying to create policy that endorses and funds comprehensive sex education and that type of thing. And among those people, I think the conversation has definitely just over the past couple of decades emerged and become normalized that yes, as women, regardless of whether we like each other, we don't have to like every other woman, but if we want to insult someone or we want to voice displeasure with someone, sexuality is not an okay place to go. I think that that's becoming more normalized around people who have tendencies towards sex positivity. But then as soon as you leave that wonderful bubble, you move on to, I think, not much has really changed in the comfort levels of people in the United States. And that's shown. I mean, the government still funds abstinence-only sex education, despite studies, many studies existing that prove that it correlates with higher rates of teen pregnancy and STIs. I mean, there is still this disconnect, is I guess my point, between the ways that we talk about it within our sex-positive communities and take for granted that people ought to feel, and the ways that, you know, as soon as you step outside of that. And even when I talk to my friends who are otherwise progressive people, who it's just, you know, it's just never occurred to them that going through your ex-boyfriend's new girlfriend's Facebook photos with your friends and slut-shaming her is really dangerous and wrong activity. You know, it's just kind of a disconnect between our personal behavior and what we hold as these overarching values. And so that takes time. But with education, I honestly am hopeful about it.
Yeah, and it brings the point that women are sometimes the cruelest bullies of one another. Where do you think that comes from? What is to be gained when women are so violent and cruel to one another?
I think it comes back to that constant threat you brought up. If we are always aware that at any point, but through no fault of our own, we could wake up one day and find that we are now a slut, and that people feel this way about us and are distancing themselves from us, whether we are a teenager in a high school and a rumor's gotten started about us, or whether, you know, we just got a promotion at our job and people are kind of whispering and disrespecting us because they assume we slept our way to the top, you know, whatever the circumstances, it's a constant threat. And we all know it, whether or not we say it out loud. And so as long as we're able to divert the attention to someone else, for the moment, we are safe. And that's not something that anyone should really be proud of, but I think it's something we can all understand and that we've all taken part in with any kind of cruelty. And slut shaming is a really easy label. It's a really quick and simple way to do that. One of my favorite scholars on the topic is Dr. Ebony Utley, and she's an intimacy expert. We interviewed her for our upcoming documentary film, and she puts it in a really great way, which is that as long as there are sluts over there, then you're over here and you're not the target. And once you use that word slut, nobody needs any more of the story, because it's such an easy label, an easy way to dismiss someone, whether she's a rape victim trying to get justice or whether she's just trying to explain that she's not ashamed about having consensual sex with that guy. I mean, whatever it is, it's an easy way to shut her up and to simply say, we don't need any more of the story. We know your type. You're just a slut. You don't get to have a voice in this issue. And women do that to each other all the time.
Oh, that is so profound and so true. Yes.
The personal story sharing, I think, is one of the best ways to work against that. Because, like I said, as soon as you share your experience, it humanizes you. And people see you as a full person who maybe likes sex, maybe had, you know, more sex partners than they would choose to have. But who cares? You're a full person. Sex doesn't define you. It's just a part of who you are. And I think that is the shift that we're looking toward. And women owe it to ourselves to make it easier for other women to do that.
Yeah. And will you talk to me about the intersection between sexual assault and slut shaming? A lot of girls hesitate to come forward after being assaulted because they fear they'll be slut shamed. Others become more promiscuous after an assault because they fear like they've lost their no. How do we address these two issues together?
It's really, it works on both sides. The overlaps between slut shaming and sexual assault are so, there's so many of them. And it works on either side. So for instance, if you have been sexually assaulted and you come forward or someone comes forward about it for you, you can retroactively be labeled a slut as a way to justify the behavior or to dismiss it. Maybe the police don't have enough time to deal with your report, or maybe people don't want to think that way about the boy that has assaulted you or the man who has done this to you. And so whatever their motivation is, slut shaming you is a really easy way to avoid having to deal with that. And to dismiss you. On the other side, as you mentioned, once you are the victim of a sexual assault, it's very common for girls to engage in unsafe sexual behavior that we would never endorse, you know, sexual behavior that is not comfortable for them and that maybe doesn't involve using birth control or protection, you know, against STIs, or that is not something they would choose to engage in otherwise. And that happened to me. I was not the victim of a sexual assault, but after I was labeled a slut, I kind of thought, you know, what the heck? People already think this about me, so I might as well give them what they want almost. And it made life worse for me, but it's a common reaction. And so one way to use that, I guess, to undo it is to make it a culture where women feel comfortable talking about their sexual assaults. It all comes back to this personal account of how you overcome it. That's not to say that anyone has a responsibility to talk about what's happened to them or to educate others as a victim. That often falls on victims. And I'm not implying that that's their responsibility, but it's our responsibility to create a culture of listeners and where we believe women when they come forward with this type of thing, so that it's more comfortable for more women to talk about it and not to normalize sexual assault, but to normalize the act of coming forward and talking about it rather than trying to get them to shut up and go away so we don't have to think about it.
And speaking of a culture of listeners, one of the great points you make about sexual bullying is that unlike other kinds of bullying, adults are not always on your side if you come forward as a teenager. And right. So as adults, how do we support teenagers in our life without crossing a line of being too intrusive about their sexuality or meddling about, you know, what did you do to deserve this? Like, what is the right response if a teenager in our life confides in us?
It depends on our relationship to that teenager, but if you're, you know, for instance, if you're a parent of a teenager and they confide in you about something, you might have a really visceral kind of uncontrollable, like knee-jerk reaction that will not be helpful to them. So if you know yourself and you know your relationship with your child and that is likely to happen, I would suggest telling them, you know, that you believe them and getting these words out of your mouth, you know, thank you for coming to me. I believe you. I need some time to think about this and then let's talk about it tonight or something like that so that you have the space to cope with your own possibly negative reactions to what they've explained without having it affect them negatively, without yelling or without unintentionally or accidentally victim blaming them, which parents do all the time. And it's no fault of parents who've grown up in this culture, honestly. I think it's a pretty common and understandable reaction to ask these questions, like what could you have done to avoid it? Why were you in that situation? It's unfortunate, but that's the world that many of us have grown up in. And so I don't think it necessarily means you're like a bad parent if that's your first reaction. What I'm saying is that you ought to have that reaction in private without having it affect your child. And then to come back when you're ready to talk about it, when you want to, you know, be there for them and have these conversations, to say, first of all, repeat over and over that you believe them and that it's not their fault. And then to ask them what they need. Counseling is almost always a good option, but it's necessary to find a counselor who's sex positive and who won't compound the damage by victim blaming. I mean, a lot of people who have licenses in marriage and family therapy, that doesn't necessarily mean that those people have sex all figured out or that they don't have their own biases coming into it. So it's important to vet counselors for the teenagers or preteens in your life who you're trying to help, to meet with them beforehand, to kind of do some online research about them and make sure that the person you're sending your child to, or if it's not your child, you know, if you're a school administrator and you're kind of trying to set them up with an outside therapist and work with their parents to do that, to make sure that person is actually going to be able to help and specializes in sexual assault recovery or whatever it is that the issue is for that person. So asking them what they need and trying to give it to them, and also coming at it with a perspective that they don't always know what they need. I mean, at that age, what you might say you need is just to be left alone. But then if you're left alone, you're more prone to self-harm or suicidal thoughts and risks. So parents kind of balancing their own potentially negative or sad or heartbroken reactions with putting on the face that your child needs to see and getting them to a therapist who can actually help them, I think, in the moment is really important. But ongoing, the groundwork needs to be laid. So for you to expect that your child is even going to come to you and confide in you about these things, you need to have set this ongoing relationship where you model accepting and sex positive behavior for them. And always from an early age, talking about in age appropriate ways, of course, talking about things they might be noticing about their bodies or other people's bodies. When media stories come up and you have the chance to help them think critically about different celebrities who might be being slut shamed, or, you know, that what happened to Jennifer Lawrence and other women celebrities who had their phones hacked and their naked pictures spread, use that as an opportunity to open a conversation, even if you don't think your kid needs it yet. I mean, providing them with the tools to be media literate and to come at these types of news stories and stories, rumors they hear about people in their own lives with compassion and with the ability to think critically about them. I think that really, I mean, it's not just I think, it's true that it really increases the chances that if they are ever the target or the witness of some kind of really dangerous slut shaming or sexual bullying or a sexual assault, they feel comfortable coming to you to talk about it, because you've demonstrated over the many years that you've been in their life as an adult that they can trust you, that you can help.
Thank you for that. I know a lot of our listeners, just as they're themselves are becoming more sex positive, they're trying to figure out how to do sex positive parenting. And I think media literacy and that open dialogue is such an important point for us all to take home. So, final question. Ultimately, slut shaming is rooted in a sex negative culture that defines sex as dirty and sinful. And I know that we're all in it together to help transform sex culture worldwide. So I like to ask the question, how would you, Emily, describe your ideal sex culture?
It would be a world in which people can do a couple of things. One is live and let live. So to recognize that other people's sex lives that don't involve you, as long as they are consensual and safe, are good. And they are none of your business. I mean, you don't have to concern yourselves with what other people do in the bedroom. That would be a first step. Attached to that would be a culture in which we all understand on a really deep level that someone's sex proclivities or orientation or behavior or whatever it is, their kinks, don't define them in every aspect of their life. And what comes to mind is in my own life, I knew that there were parents in my high school, as an example, who were swingers. So I'll use a personal example here. And other parents found out that they were swingers, and we weren't allowed to go play with their kids. Like, we weren't allowed to socialize with their kids. And the assumption was, even though nobody really voiced it directly, that people who behave in sexual activity that is not the sexual activity you would behave, you would engage in, or that doesn't feel right for you, that somehow that taints or colors their whole life and everything about the way they are and the everything they do. Like, they can't be good parents if they're into BDSM, or they can't be good at their job if they have an open relationship with their partner. You know, all these assumptions that we make that whatever someone is into sexually, if it's something that doesn't feel right in your life, they're written off in all ways, in all aspects of their life, that it defines them somehow as an other. And a culture that I would be so much happier in, and that I'm hoping for and working toward, is one in which that assumption doesn't exist. One in which we don't assume anything about people based on their sex life. We let them share with us as they feel comfortable sharing. We say, good for you, not for me, that's fine, and leave it at that. It doesn't need to be a conversation. It doesn't need to be a big deal or anything that's a news story. That would be the culture that I hope exists in the near future.
Beautiful. Let's all work towards that together. And just to wrap up, you have two big projects coming up. Can you briefly tell us about what you are working on?
Yes, I'm so excited. We have crowdfunded successfully Unslut, a documentary film. We used to call it Slut, a documentary film, but we threw the Unslut in front of it instead to be more in line with the mission and our work. And so this film shares the stories of women who were brave enough to talk about their experiences overcoming slut shaming on camera. And it also features a lot of experts and their takes on how we got to where we are and how we can work forward toward a better world that doesn't engage in slut shaming in the same ways. And that is now available for screenings. We're using TUGG, T-U-G-G. It's a platform where people can set up their own screenings and license the film, either in a community theater or in a bigger theater or in living rooms and community centers around the world for screenings starting in September. So it's open now to set up and to start organizing that type of thing. And the screenings will be starting in September all over the country and the world. And that's really exciting. So that's the first thing. And that you can find out about that at our website, unslutproject.com. And my diary, which started the whole project, is turned into a book. And by Zest Books, they're publishing it in the end of December of this year. So that's available for pre-order also on the website.
Awesome. The Unslut Project continues. Emily, thank you so much for sharing your wisdom and voice with us today.
Of course. Thank you. It's been really lovely talking to you.
And listeners, if you want to learn more from Emily, you can visit her at unslutproject.com. And we'll, of course, link that up on the show's page over at pleasuremechanics.com.